This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Jonathan Moreno. Dr. Moreno is the Emily Davy and Joseph S. Cornfield Professor of Biomedical Ethics and Director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Welcome to California Politics Today.
Thank you very much, Mark.
You're the co-chair of the National Academy of Sciences committee that issued guidelines for embryonic stem cell research today. Could you give us a concise overview of what you were trying to do with this set of guidelines?
Well, as you know, the federal government currently has very restricted funding of embryonic stem cell research and has really issued no detailed rules for the people who are doing research with respect to what is appropriate and what isn't. And of course, it's also true that there are other funding sources coming online that have nothing to do with federal money. Of course, in California, you have your own California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, and there are a number of other states that are contemplating competing with you, and there, of course, are private companies that are also waiting to get into this area. So we felt, the scientific community, felt that it was really a problem that there were no detailed guidelines for doing human embryonic stem cell research. And the National Academies, as a non-governmental but governmental advisory body, we're in a position to get the requisite expertise and put these guidelines together. And we hope it will create not only some uniformity for the scientists, but also reassure the public that this work can go forward ethically.
Okay. Now, one of the major recommendations was that ESCROs, or Embryonic Stem Cell Research Oversight Committees, be established at institutions overseeing this research.
That's correct.
What will be the composition and function of those ESCROs?
Well, they'll have to be people who are familiar with the biology, with artificial reproductive technologies. They have to be people who know about the bioethical, regulatory, and legal issues, and also members who can represent the public, because this is not just a scientific question. There are these ethical questions, social questions. And their job will be to review proposals that scientists make to do things like, as we enumerate our report, just to give you an example, creating new lines of embryonic stem cells from embryos, perhaps embryos taken from IVF clinics with the permission of the people who were the sources of the sperm and egg and the embryo. And those experiments will have to be reviewed by these committees to ensure that there is a good justification for creating a new line of stem cells. This is a kind of thing that can be done now without any review or any management at all. So what we're trying to do is create a system that's a pretty tight system that requires the scientists to justify why they're doing what they propose to do.
Okay, now I did an interview earlier today with Richard Dorflinger, who's a spokesperson for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and he compared the creation of these committees to a committee to review Pinto safety put together by Ford Motor Corporation, and he meant to say that all that was going to be done here was a lot of paperwork, but the ethical issues would be avoided. What's your response to that point of view?
Well, of course, the committees that he's describing would be composed of people from within the Ford Motor Corporation, if they ever had such committees,
right,
who would be obviously conflicted. These are people who have nothing to gain or lose on these committees. They cannot be conflicted. In other words, in the science world, that means they cannot be people who are actually involved in doing these experiments that they're reviewing.
Okay.
They will have to have the suitable expertise, and there will be somebody from outside the institution who can help to provide that community input that I described earlier. So I understand that Richard Dorflinger is very much opposed to human embryonic stem cell research, but I don't think he can really indict this process. This is a process that's in place, very similar process that's in place for doing reviews of human experiments, and these people meet all the time, and they have community representation. And we felt that it was necessary to have a similar oversight role with respect to human embryonic stem cell research.
If members of the community believe that blastocysts our human life and ought not to be destroyed for any purpose, will that point of view be taken into account by these escrows?
Well, of course, like our committee,
right?
People who serve on these escrow committees are going to have to adopt the view that human embryonic stem cell research in general is ethical.
Right.
But they will also have to make a judgment about what kinds of experiments are not ethical.
Right. But within the context of the established ethicalness of taking stem cells as cell masses out of blastocysts and destroying the blastocysts, that's a given for anyone to be on these committees.
That's
isn't
correct.
It?
You would have to agree that there would have to, that there would be some circumstances under which it would be ethical to do this research.
Okay.
If you didn't agree with that, then you'd be wasting time on the committee. These escrow committees, these local review committees that we proposed, like our own National Academy of Sciences committee, presumed that, as the academies have said 2 years ago, that both embryonic and adult stem cell research should go forward. They both show promise, but they show promise in different areas and to different degrees.
Okay. What I'd like to address is something that came as something of a surprise to me. I've been following this for a while, and I hadn't really known much about this issue. So-called chimeras that result from the mixing of human and animal cells.
Right.
Is this something that a lot of people want to get involved with or are already doing, and therefore you needed to set these guidelines out?
Well, first of all, nobody has grappled with this question.
Right.
In the United States, anyway. So we felt it was obligatory to do it, especially since, yes, this could be a very important laboratory technique. Now, in fact, mixing of cells and tissues from different sources does happen quite a bit. As you probably know, there are animal models for all kinds of diseases.
Right.
And they have sometimes been designed to knock in or knock out certain proteins, and some of them human proteins.
Right.
And this is critical for understanding how our genes and proteins work, and very often for the first steps in assessing whether a drug has any potential or not. So how would this work in the case of stem cells? Well, let's imagine that you were trying, as people are trying, in fact, are with some apparent success, you're trying to see if you can cause human stem cells to differentiate into the kinds of cells that you find in a human pancreas.
Right.
Well, you could, in other words, to treat the diabetes.
Right.
You could not ethically start your experiments with human beings. You would try to put, you would try to get those cells that we hope will emit insulin.
Right.
You try to get them into the pancreas of a rodent.
Right.
Now, those are human pancreatic cells.
Right.
That would go into the rodent. Now, most people, I think, don't have a problem with that, but we have to be careful and acknowledge that some people would have trouble. For example, if you were interested in Parkinson's or ALS or Alzheimer's, a neurologic disorder,
right,
and you wanted to put human stem cells that have been differentiated into neural cells, human neural cells, into a mouse blastocyst,
right,
to see if, in the first instance, if they get to where they're supposed to get, to the mouse brain. Well, some people may have trouble with that. Some people may be very concerned that you would end up with human intellectual characteristics in a rodent.
Right.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. And again, that's the kind of experiment that could be done now without necessarily having review. So we have urged that there be a system in which these escrow committees we talked about earlier would have to look at these experiments and monitor them. If they approve them, they would have to establish the conditions under which they could proceed.
Okay, so as I'm looking at the press release announcing these guidelines, it says experiments in which there is a possibility that human cells could contribute in a, quote, major organized way, end quote, to the brain of an animal require strong scientific justification.
Right.
Meaning that you don't rule that out.
Don't rule it out, because, again, if you're concerned about Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or stroke, these are the kinds of experiments that the FDA will actually require be done before any kind of biological material could go into market.
Okay, because as I'm thinking about this, I'm trying to imagine, this was something I hadn't thought of before today and before I heard about this,
yeah,
that you're going to end up with a potential genius scientist in the body of a mouse in Dr. Irving Weissman's lab at Stanford, and
The genius would probably be Irving Weissman.
Sorry?
The genius would probably be Dr. Weissman.
Yes, that's right. and you'll end up with the mice organizing like graduate students, or who knows what'll happen.
We can't have that.
And so I'm wondering, is this a it's starting to sound like Dr. Moreau to me. Is this something that needs more discussion than the minute or two we're going to be able to give it here?
It does, but I should add that the neuroscientists I talk to do not believe that that this could happen. You could end up with a talking mouse,
right?
Somebody recently put it.
Well, it would be even worse though if they didn't have the ability to vocalize, but they had the ability to realize the consciousness. They'd start scratching. It sounds like Flowers for Algernon and Charlie now.
Right. Exactly. You're showing your age.
Yes.
I remember that movie too.
Yes.
But before that could possibly happen, you would start to see things happening in the embryo and fetal mouse.
It would light up in a human way.
Exactly. You'd see structures and things that we would certainly recognize. And then you would just have to stop the experiment.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop this interview pretty soon, but I wanted to ask you one more question. It's implicit in your, and I think also explicit in your guidelines, that human reproductive cloning,
right,
nuclear somatic cell nuclear transfer, followed by the implantation of a viable embryo into a uterus to be
not
brought
acceptable
to term,
yeah,
is not acceptable.
Not acceptable.
But I wanted to ask you whether you think that all of the other research, short of that or other than that, is necessarily going to enhance the technology and the techniques and the experience of the researchers doing it, which, when coupled with the fact that IVF is pretty advanced and mm-hmm. and pretty successful a lot of the time, that the temptation, the possibility, accidental or deliberate, for human reproductive cloning to take place in one of these labs under some circumstances is going to be enhanced as well, and whether there's a danger from that and what kind of steps you think ought to be taken to avoid it.
Very reasonable question, but the implantation barrier is really a profound one, because the problems that seem to occur during gestation, as after implantation, during pregnancy,
right,
we've seen with other mammals,
right,
those are some of the issues that you would want to see if you could sort out.
Right.
If you're really interested in using cloning for reproduction,
but
you won't have the opportunity to do that.
The Italians just created a colt from a gelded champion that seems to be genetically identical to the originating source, and so far the horse looks pretty good.
Right, but again, you wouldn't know if you'd refined your techniques for doing that if you couldn't implant it. So you won't know. You would never be able to learn under our rules whether your manipulations have succeeded in getting a healthy clone.
Right, but of course, sort of the same principle that allows you to do research in non-human species to see how processes that do take place in humans take place in these experimental conditions also means that all of the cloning for reproductive purposes done with sheep and horses and frogs and rabbits can also contribute to the knowledge of scientists before they do any human reproductive cloning.
It certainly could, but here's the irony.
Right.
We're in a situation in which there is no guidance.
Right.
And that's a situation in which there's much more likely to be abuse.
Right.
Remember what's happened with the in vitro fertilization industry, not to damn the whole industry.
Right.
But, you know, the fact is that it's taken a long time for the industry to begin to apply standards.
Right.
And that was partly because the federal government took itself out of the business of investing in research in IVF in 1980, and therefore could not impose any regulation. So, you know, we are, I think, much more likely to have abuses without guidance and without regulation and without oversight of the kind that we proposed than we are with it.
Okay. Why don't we wrap up by letting you address these guidelines and your issuing of them in the context of what's going on, particularly in the U.S. Congress, where some legislation is being proposed now that would allow for the creation of new stem cell lines with federal funding from excess IVF embryos, some that would provide money for therapeutic cloning activities, and Senator Brownback's bill, S-650, 58 that would prohibit both therapeutic and reproductive cloning and presumably put the kibosh on all of this.
Yes.
What's the political purpose, if there is one, of your issuing these guidelines, and what do you hope to achieve within the context of the political debates that are going on about how much
process,
and whether this research ought to continue?
Mark, this process was so hard. It was so intellectually challenging.
Right.
And so time-consuming. I mean, I still have a day job.
Right.
For the last 9 months. We did not have time to worry about was tracking the legislation or worrying about where more money was going to come from the research. We were really trying to get this right. I know that sounds hard to believe.
Right. No, it doesn't.
For a Washington-based report, but, you know, I'm not a political scientist. I know as much about the legislation, actually less.
Right.
You do. You know the numbers. I don't even know the numbers,
right.
the bills. And, of course, that itself, it's been a moving target for the last 8 months, too.
Right.
So we were absolutely, totally non-preoccupied with how this was or was not going to dovetail.
Well, now that you finished it, and maybe as you'll have a chance to see some of this political activity.
Yes, and I will observe it with great interest.
Okay. Well, maybe in a week or so, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we can talk to you again and maybe some of the other members of the committee and get their views on that aspect of their work.
Be happy to do that.
Thanks very much for taking the time to do all this and for talking to us about it today on California Politics Today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.